Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Heart of the Matter. This week, we present the last of a three-part series titled A History of Ireland as it relates to the Ulster Scots. Now, we want to thank Reverend Ivan Foster for the time and the work he put into this historical account. Here again, then, is Reverend Foster.
Hindsight would tell us that one of the purposes served by the glorious 1859 revival was the strengthening of the biblical convictions of the Protestant people of Ulster to ready them to meet the onslaught of the campaign for Home Rule for Ireland, which became the chief feature of Irish politics in the last quarter of the 19th century and the first quarter of the 20th century. When William Gladstone came to power in Westminster for the first time, he served as Prime Minister on four separate occasions, he was faced with an Ireland increasingly agitated with various campaigns, all of which sought separation from the United Kingdom in one form or other. He had become impressed by the political stance of a young Protestant land owner, Charles Stuart Parnell, who headed up the Home Rule movement. Gladstone described him as the most remarkable person he had ever met. This admiration showed itself in the efforts Gladstone made to have the Westminster Parliament pass a Home Rule Bill. He made two attempts. The first was in 1886. It was defeated in the House of Commons. In 1893 he tried again with a little more success. The second Irish Home Rule Bill passed the House of Commons but was defeated in the House of Lords. Gladstone died in 1898. The Home Rule cause did not reappear on Westminster's agenda until after the 1910 general election, when the Nationalist Irish Parliamentary Party, under its leader John Redmond, held the balance of power in the House of Commons. Prime Minister H.H. Asquith came to an understanding with Redmond that if he supported his move to break the power of the House of Lords, whereby he could have his finance bill passed, Asquith would then in return introduce a new Home Rule Bill. True to his promise to Redmond, Asquith introduced the third Home Rule Bill in 1912. As in 1886 and 1893, it was ferociously opposed by Ulster Unionists, for whom Home Rule was seen as Rome Rule, but it was passed, nevertheless, by Parliament. The spiritual influences of the 1859 revival were seen in this view of Home Rule. For Unionists, it meant a Dublin Parliament dominated by the Roman Catholic Church, a threat to their cultural identity as British, and discrimination against them as a religious minority. This spiritual perception of the threat of Rome Rule was the result of the heightened awareness of all things biblical and spiritual which sprang from the 1859 revival. This awareness of the dangers posed by Home Rule was not the only indication of the revival's effect upon the minds and hearts of Ulster Protestants. There were other indications displayed in their response to Home Rule. For a start, the three main churches, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, the Church of Ireland, and the Methodist Church in Ireland, all gave united leadership in opposition to Rome Rule. We have mentioned the Presbyterian Church in Ireland and the Anglican Church of Ireland on a number of occasions in these programmes, but have never spoken of the Methodist Church and its role in the spiritual life of Ireland. Now might be an appropriate time. In 1747, one of John Wesley's preachers, a Welshman called Thomas Williams, came to Dublin from England and formed what was to be the first permanent Methodist society in Ireland. John Wesley visited Dublin in August of the same year to meet this society. Not long after Wesley's return to England, a riot broke out in Dublin, and the premises in which the Methodists were meeting were badly damaged. Wesley sent his younger brother Charles to the city to rally the frightened members. Samuel Handy, a gentleman with an estate in County Westmeath, heard that one of his family had become involved with the Methodists and hurried to Dublin to remonstrate with her. She persuaded him to meet them, and the meeting convinced him of their value. He offered his residence, Coolaloch, in the parish of Ardnuchar, as a base from which they might work in the Irish Midlands. The offer was, of course, accepted and Handy introduced the preachers to his relations and friends within a radius of about 35 miles from his house. Within months, half a dozen societies had been formed in the area. Later, others would do something similar, and Methodism spread along a chain of family connections. John Wesley sent other preachers from England to pioneer in different counties. They tended to visit the cities and market towns, and to attract attention by preaching wherever they could attract a crowd. Wesley began to visit Ireland regularly to encourage the societies they formed, and the growth of the movement can be plotted by his lengthening itineraries, first to the south and west, and then to the north. His first visit to Ulster was in 1752. As a Calvinist, I do not agree with many of the doctrines the Methodist preachers proclaim. However, I cannot but admire the courage and zeal many of them showed in the face of persecution, not only from Romanists, but also from spiritually dead so-called Protestant ministers. I must mention one man amongst these early pioneers, Gideon Ouseley. Married at the age of 20, Gideon Ouseley led a wild life that wasted both his own and his wife's fortunes. After losing an eye when shot in a tavern brawl, a loss that reputedly left him with a frightening appearance, Ouseley left his wild ways behind him. In 1791 he was converted to Christ by the witness of some English soldiers stationed in Dunmore, County Galway. He set out to win his family and friends to Christ. Gideon Ouseley preached the gospel, mostly in Ulster, until his death. His knowledge of the Irish language and his eccentric preaching astride a white horse won him renown as Methodism's apostle to the Irish. I have read with joy accounts of some of his meetings with God and of his experiences of the power and glory of the Holy Ghost in those days of blessing. He may not have agreed with my Calvinism, but I would have delighted in the power of God that rested upon him. All the membership of all three churches, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, the Church of Ireland, and the Methodist Church in Ireland, had greatly benefited from the revival of 1859, and it showed in the strong anti-home rule stance of their leaders. What a contrast to today's ecumenical, unfaithful, and deceitful church leaders. Even amongst the political responses of the political leaders, the influence of the revival was seen. Edward Carson and James Craig, leaders of the Unionists, were instrumental in organizing the Ulster Covenant against the coercion of Ulster. The Covenant, which was styled after the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643, when the Scottish Covenanters at that time made a political and military alliance with the leaders of the English parliamentarians. Even in this can be seen the influence of God stirring men to recall the mercies their forefathers had enjoyed at his hand in times of danger and distress, and the means of deliverance they sought. The Ulster Covenant was signed by 237,368 men, and the similarly worded declaration by 234,046 women in and around the 28th of September, 1912. In January 1913, some 100,000 Ulster men banded together into the Ulster Volunteer Force to resist the imposing of Home Rule. Successful steps were taken to smuggle arms to Ulster to arm the Volunteer Force. But the schemers behind the Home Rule Bill were to be denied their victory. The Third Irish Home Rule Bill, passed by Parliament, never came into force, due to the intervention of World War I and of the later Easter Rising in Dublin in 1916. I might just add that the Ulster Volunteer Force became the basis of the 36th Ulster Division, a division of Lord Kitchener's New Army formed in September 1914. Members of the Ulster Volunteer Force formed 13 additional battalions for 3 existing regiments, the Royal Irish Fusiliers, the Royal Irish Rifles, and the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers. The 36th was one of the few divisions to make significant gains on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. According to military historian Martin Middlebrook, the leading battalions of the 36th Ulster Division had been ordered out just before 7:30 a.m. At 0 hour, bugles blew the advance. Up sprang the Ulster men, and without forming up in the waves adopted by other divisions, they rushed to the German front line. By a combination of sensible tactics and Ulster dash, the prize that eluded so many, the capture of a long section of the German front line, had been accomplished. During the Battle of the Somme, the Ulster Division was the only division of 10th Corps to have achieved its objective on the opening day of the battle. This came at a heavy price, with the division suffering in 2 days of fighting 5,500 officers and men killed, wounded, or missing. War correspondent Philip Gibbs said of the division, "Their attack was one of the finest displays of human courage in the world." There were few homes in Ulster that did not suffer loss in that dark day. Of 9 Victoria Crosses given to British forces in the battle, 4 were awarded to 36th Division soldiers. In 1916, the Easter Rising took place in Dublin. The Rising was mounted by Irish Republicans with the aim of ending British rule in Ireland at a time when the United Kingdom was heavily engaged in World War I. It utterly failed, due mostly to the confused leadership of the Irish Volunteer. A letter from their commander, Éan MacNeill, was a last-minute attempt to cancel the Easter Rising. That letter, which spread great confusion amongst the volunteers, helps explain the fact that instead of some 10,000 men taking part in the rebellion across Ireland, only 2,000 in the Dublin area took part. Doubtless, we can see again the providential mercy of God in this failure. But out of the attempted rebellion there arose to the fore in Irish politics the political party that has long been espoused to murder and terror and has been guilty of innumerable incidents of slaughter and mayhem in the intervening 100 years. I am referring to Sinn Féin. After the failure of the Rising, Republicans came together under the banner of Sinn Féin. In the 1918 general election, Sinn Féin won 73 of Ireland's 105 seats in the House of Commons. And in January 1919, its MPs assembled in Dublin and proclaimed themselves Dáil Éireann, the Parliament of Ireland. In Westminster, the issue of Ireland and Home Rule arose once more after World War I, although this time the coercion of the Ulster Protestants into a Roman Catholic-dominated Irish Free State was unthinkable in London. The sacrifice of Ulster men in the Great War made that so. The 4th and final Home Rule Bill partitioned the island. The 6 counties of Northern Ireland were established within the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the 26 counties became known as the Irish Free State. The formation of Northern Ireland and its exclusion from an All-Ireland settlement divided the Sinn Féin movement, and a civil war was the result. The Free State Party, which favoured the settlement as the best they were likely to get, triumphed, and the hardline Sinn Féin members under Éamon de Valera were defeated. In Northern Ireland, the new political entity settled quickly into the business of government. The armed section of Sinn Féin known as the Irish Republican Army or the IRA, mounted guerrilla raids on Northern Ireland's borders, as well as from within strongly populated Roman Catholic areas inside Northern Ireland. However, God had yet more mercy for the people of Ulster. An Ulster native, William Patterson Nicholson, was a preacher born in Bangor, County Down, in April 1876. W.P., as he was later to be affectionately known, began to preach the gospel of Christ in 1899, at the age of 23. He spent some years in California and in various other places in the United States, and was known as a man who used straightforward language which greatly appealed to the common man. In the providence of God, this man was directed to return to his native land in 1920, and he began preaching in a series of gospel missions which were visited by the blessed power of heaven, and revival broke out. The period immediately after the formation of the Northern Ireland state was one of great unrest. Irish Republicans from within the boundaries of the infant state and from the border area separating it from the Irish Free State, as the 26-county southern state ruled from Dublin was known, engaged in acts of terrorism against the security forces and against anything linked to the new administration. Telephone exchanges, custom posts, and the like were regularly attacked. The Royal Ulster Constabulary was formed, and it in turn was supported by auxiliary forces comprised of part-time policemen. They were known as A Specials, that is, full-time support units, B Specials, part-time units, and for a time, C Specials. This latter force was only to be called upon in an emergency. These forces were very successful against IRA marauders, mainly due to the fact that they were comprised of local men patrolling their own area, and therefore they were able to identify very quickly any suspicious outsiders on the move. However, far above the efforts of these brave men, who were, of course, very open to attack by the IRA as they went about their ordinary daytime employment, there was another agency which played a major and decisive part in the quelling of the early violence and terror. I mentioned that W.P. Nicholson, a fiery evangelist, had returned to his native land in 1920. He immediately began a series of meetings in various major centres in the east of the province. Hundreds of people were saved in these meetings. I had an opportunity, when a member of the Northern Ireland Assembly in the early 1980s, to search the records library of the Parliament buildings in Stormont, Belfast, and discover figures related to murder and terror during the first 10 years of Northern Ireland. It was most remarkable that after a few years, when the victims of terror and murder were numbered in their hundreds annually, the numbers very rapidly declined until, in the early 1930s, they had fallen to single figures. Indeed, some years in the 1930s saw no murders committed at all. Regardless of our appreciation of the bravery of our security forces, I do not think that it was their labours alone that saw the decline in terrorism and murder. No, the blessing of God through the preaching of the Word of God had a sanctifying, sobering impact upon our state in the days of its infancy. One example of the impact of W.P. Nicholson's preaching may be seen in the fact that the great shipyard in Belfast, Harland and Wolff, was required to allocate a huge shed to receive the stolen tools and items of equipment returned by men converted to Christ and convicted of their stealing in Mr. Nicholson's meetings. The gospel turned men from more than stealing. It turned many from crimes of violence and murder, and this is illustrated in the annual police crime figures I have already referred to. To this day, there are many Christian families who can trace the mercy of God within their family back to the meetings and missions of W.P. Nicholson. A story involving my own mother when she was a girl of 16 in the employment of a Christian doctor and his wife in Bangor, County Down, in 1924, illustrates the impact of this man of God. My mother was invited to share the evening meal with the doctor and his family one Lord's Day when the guest was W.P. Nicholson. He asked my mother if she was saved. My mother, a good Episcopalian and ignorant of all evangelical truth to a great extent, replied, "Oh no, I am Church of Ireland." Mr. Nicholson urged upon her the claims of the Gospel of Christ and said in closing, "Should you ever get married and have a son, may God make him a preacher." My mother had three sons. Two of them died in infancy, and I was the third and the only one to survive. She quietly told me that story one day, quite some time after I was saved and seeking to serve the Lord in the gospel ministry. I could see that she was pondering upon and savouring the great mercy of God to her that was linked to that blessing pronounced so long ago by a great man of God. Like Mary of old, she had kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. Luke chapter 2, verse 19. I am sure that there are many other stories that could be told by people still, and will be told one day, of the workings of God through his servant, W.P. Nicholson. He passed away and went to his reward on the 29th of October, 1959. Although in the mercy of God, IRA terrorism declined, it never went away completely. Political relations south of the border were complex and volatile. The IRA remained prepared to take over the country by insurrection. In November 1926, the IRA seized 11 Garda barracks, as the Free State Police Force was called, shooting dead two Gardai. The Free State immediately used its Special Powers Act to intern 110 IRA men. The very next day, when Eamon de Valera's Fianna Fáil party won the 1932 election, Republican prisoners were released and the organization legalized. However, in 1935, the IRA was banned once again. De Valera's government increasingly followed a strict anti-IRA policy. De Valera's political position had altered, for by entering government he had accepted the terms of the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty. De Valera was now deemed a traitor by Sinn Féin and the hardline IRA. The ideology of the IRA shifted to the left and became communistic. De Valera's Free State government initiated anti-IRA legislation that was far more repressive than anything the Northern Ireland government contemplated. This was largely out of a need to protect itself from the possibility of a coup d'etat by the IRA, which had still a large body of sympathy in the Irish Free State. In January 1939, the IRA Army Council declared war against Britain, and a sabotage campaign began a few days later. On the 23rd of December 1939, IRA members stole almost the entire reserve ammunition store of the Irish Army from the magazine fort in Dublin's Phoenix Park. This became known as the Christmas Raid in IRA folklore. The Irish Minister for Justice, Gerald Boland, at an emergency session of the Dáil, introduced the Emergency Powers Bill to reinstate internment, the military tribunal, and execution for IRA members. It was rushed through and given its third reading the next day, creating the Emergency Powers Act. When the Second World War started, Northern Ireland threw itself into the war effort. Tens of thousands of men volunteered for the armed forces. In contrast, the Irish Free State declared itself neutral, and the swastika flew in Dublin throughout the war years, only lowered on one occasion, the death of Hitler in 1945. De Valera formally offered his condolences to the German minister in Dublin on that occasion. This did damage to Ireland. particularly in the United States. When the USA entered the war in 1941, the first U.S. troops to land in Europe did so in Northern Ireland in 1942. All told, some 300,000 troops were stationed here and made welcome during the conflict. My own cousin married a GI and after the war went to live with her husband in Florida, where members of her family still reside. There was no welcome for the troops in what is now the Irish Republic. American citizens, especially those who are the descendants of those gallant men who landed on Ulster soil some 72 years ago and who joined in common cause with the British citizens in Ulster against the terrorism of Nazi Germany, should bear that in mind. After the Second World War, Ireland was declared to be a republic in 1949, and all links that remained to the United Kingdom were abolished. There was some measure of regrouping by the IRA, and in the mid-50s, they commenced a border campaign, which at first received sympathy and support from the South. However, internment without trial, introduced first in Northern Ireland and then in the Republic of Ireland, curtailed IRA operations and ultimately broke its morale. 18 people in total were killed during the campaign, of whom 7 were members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary and 8 were members of the IRA itself. The campaign was on the whole a failure. It petered out in the late 1950s and was officially ended in February 1962. I have no doubt that one of the lasting legacies of the ministry of W.P. Nicholson was the formation of the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster in 1951. The link with the man is even more obvious when we recall that at the first morning service of Ravenhill Evangelical Church, after the ordination and installation of its new young minister, Ian Paisley, in 1946, W.P. stood up and congratulated the young minister and prayed for God's blessing upon him, asking the Lord that he might be given a tongue to be used against the Lord's enemies, as rough as that of an old cow. 5 years later, the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster was born in Crossgar, County Down. Ian Paisley found himself in a battle for the gospel of Christ after the church hall of Lissara Presbyterian Church was refused to the elders of that church when they invited him to conduct a gospel mission. The elders, encouraged by Ian Paisley, separated from Lissara Church, and the first Free Presbyterian congregation was born. So began a witness which, at least to some degree, emulated the spread of the gospel out of Ireland in the days following the preaching of Patrick. Today, the Free Presbyterian banner flies in all 5 continents. To God alone be the glory. But the hardest of times for Ulster in many a year were about to begin. In the early 1960s, civil rights became a slogan justifying insurrection and disorder in many lands. In Ulster, this seemingly innocuous demand became the cover for a campaign of terror which lasted over 30 years and cost the lives of over 3,550 people, of whom more than 1,800 were civilian, 1,117 were security force members, 399 were Republican terrorists, and 162 were loyalists engaged in terrorism. To the world, the IRA made its case for terrorism on the basis that Roman Catholics in Northern Ireland suffered persecution and had to be defended and liberated. The truth is that the IRA killed a very large number of Roman Catholics. The story of Mrs. Jean McConville, aged 37, a widow with 10 children, who was abducted and killed by the IRA because she gave aid to a dying soldier at her front door at Divis Flats, Belfast, is well known. She became one of the disappeared. Mrs. McConville's remains were buried at Templetown Beach, Carlingford, County Louth, and accidentally found by members of the public while they were walking on Shelling Hill Beach. The remarkable courage and quiet dignity of her family during their long ordeal are in stark contrast to the utter callousness and ruthlessness of their mother's killers. high-ranking IRA members are on record as stating that Gerry Adams, frequent visitor to the White House in Washington, gave the orders for her murder. Were Roman Catholics persecuted in Northern Ireland during the days prior to the IRA campaign? The situation for Roman Catholics in one area of civil administration, that of education, serves to illustrate the conditions under which they lived in Ulster. Prior to the late 1940s, state education was provided as free to all. If a Protestant or Roman Catholic wished to educate their child outside the state system, then they had to pay for that provision. The Roman Catholic people chose to do that. From the introduction of the Education Act of 1947, Roman Catholic schools were partly state-funded, but organized and controlled by the Council for Catholic-maintained Schools, who approved and appointed all its own teachers. At first, the funding was in the region of a 60% grant for the erection of buildings. That was increased progressively until, in the 1980s, 100% grant for all building programs, school equipment, and teachers' salary was given. Such aid was never available to Protestants. We here in Kilskerry operate an independent Christian school for which there is not one penny of government support available. So much for discrimination against Roman Catholics. Far from being persecuted, the Roman Catholic Church, while publicly and frequently disclaiming all support for IRA violence, has nevertheless been linked through the activities of a significant number of its priests to the IRA campaign. Over the years, I have reported on these incidents, but perhaps the most notorious was the case of the bombing of Clawdy, a quiet County Londonderry village. 9 people, including a young girl, were killed, and 30 were injured when 3 car bombs exploded in July 1972. According to an article in the London Telegraph of August 24th, 2010, Father, inverted commas, James Chesney's role in the IRA attack was covered up. The Northern Ireland Police, then the Royal Ulster Constabulary, were prevented from investigating the role of the priest after the London government, for Northern Ireland was then under direct rule from London, and the Roman Catholic Church conspired to protect him. Chesney was transferred to a parish in County Donegal, outside the Northern Ireland jurisdiction, following secret talks between the 1972 Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, William Whitelaw, and the head of the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland at that time, Cardinal William Conway. No one has ever been charged with the murders at Clawdy. At that time, the present Deputy First Minister of the Northern Ireland Executive, Martin McGuinness, was the IRA's second-in-command in Londonderry, which is just 9 miles from Clawdy. Chesney died in 1980, aged 46. Details of the cover-up were revealed in a report by the Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman in 2010. The police recently announced that they were suspending the investigation into the Clawdy murders as they could not proceed any further with the investigation. In 2002, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Derry, Dr. Seamus Hegarty, said, "It is a matter of public record that Father Chesney was a priest of good standing in the Diocese of Derry. Only in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, Romans 2 and 16, will the full details of the involvement of the Church of Rome in the terrorism inflicted upon the people of Ulster be fully known. Enough is known at present to suspect that many, many more of our clerics were actively engaged in IRA atrocities. While the Protestant community is not without its faults and sins, and from its ranks there have come those who have been guilty of the vilest of crimes, it must be noted that there has not been the retaliation against Roman Catholics, which perhaps in other communities would have been felt thoroughly warranted, and that where there has been retaliation, it has been utterly repudiated by the general Protestant populace. how different this is from the support given by Roman Catholics to Sinn Féin IRA and its campaign of terror. That support has never faltered at the ballot box, but rather increased. And that is not to be wondered at when there were within the ranks of the Roman Catholic clerics men like James Chesney. There is a peace that is more dangerous, more deadly than war. There is an enemy with a smile on his face more destructive than one with a sword in his hand. War wearies a people, and they are less inclined to caution and prudence when a tempting possible way to peace is set before them. After 30 years of vicious terrorism and slaughter at the hands of the Irish Republican Army, political chicanery and betrayal by successive Westminster governments, and the devious slyness of the main so-called Protestant churches, not to mention the ineffective and self-seeking politicking by local unionist politicians, the Ulster Protestant was brought to a state where peace, at any price, was to be welcomed. That was made very evident in the vote which followed the Good Friday Agreement of April 1998. The Good Friday Agreement involved Irish nationalism being brought into a power-sharing arrangement with unionists in a Stormont regime. 71% of the Northern Ireland population voted in favour of the Good Friday Agreement on May the 22nd, 1998. The vote indicated that a very large section of the Protestant people had voted in favour of the agreement. Direct rule by London came to an end when power was formally devolved to the new Northern Ireland Assembly, which met in Parliament Buildings, Stormont, on the 2nd of December 1999. An essential part of the Good Friday Agreement was the decommissioning of all terrorist weapons. Two political parties, Sinn Féin and the Progressive Unionist Party, were linked to paramilitary organisations. The Provisional Irish Republican Army and the Ulster Volunteer Force, respectively. Both the British and the Irish governments committed themselves to the early release of prisoners serving sentences in connection with activities of paramilitary groups, provided that those groups continued to maintain a complete and unequivocal ceasefire. May 2000 was set as the date for the total disarming of all paramilitary groups. This was not achieved, causing the Northern Ireland Assembly to be suspended on a number of occasions as a consequence of unionist objections. A series of rounds of decommissioning of arms by the IRA took place in October 2001, April 2002, and October 2003. And in July 2005, the IRA announced the formal end of its campaign. The only party to oppose the Good Friday Agreement was the Democratic Unionist Party, led by Dr. Ian Paisley. The new administration was beset by problems which were naturally exploited by the DUP. The Assembly and Executive were established, as we have said, in December 1999 on the understanding that decommissioning of all terrorist arms would begin immediately. But the Assembly and its Executive were suspended within 2 months due to a lack of progress on arms decommissioning. The Assembly and Executive were re-established in May 2000, as provisional IRA decommissioning eventually began. Aside from the decommissioning issue, however, ongoing paramilitary activity on a lower level compared to the past by the Provisional Irish Republican Army continued. Arms importations, smuggling, organised crime, punishment beating, intelligence gathering and rioting were continuing unabated and created great difficulties for the advocates of the new arrangements. A large portion of the Unionist population began to regret the support they had given to the Ulster Unionist Party and its embracing of the Good Friday Agreement, and began to swing towards the DUP and its opposition to the agreement and its calling of the agreement a betrayal of Ulster. The overall result of these problems was to damage confidence among Unionists in the Good Friday Agreement. The anti-agreement DUP defeated the pro-agreement Ulster Unionist Party, led by David Trimble, in the 2003 Assembly election. Following the change of political power, in 2004 negotiations were held between the British and Irish governments, the DUP and Sinn Féin, on an agreement to re-establish the institutions of devolved government. These talks initially failed. On the 26th of September 2005, it was announced that the Provisional Irish Republican Army had completely decommissioned its arsenal of weapons and put them beyond use. Nonetheless, many Unionists, most notably the DUP, remained sceptical, and agreement on how to restore the power-sharing assembly still had not been reached as of July 2006. Further negotiations, behind closed doors, took place in October 2006, and these led to the infamous St. Andrews Agreement. It was during these negotiations that the DUP changed its position, doubtless seeing the opportunity for power, since it had replaced the Ulster Unionist Party as the largest Unionist party, indeed the largest party, in Northern Ireland. However, were it to accept power sharing, it would be able to nominate the one who would hold the office of the First Minister. But Sinn Féin had overtaken the Social Democratic and Labour Party as the largest Irish nationalist / Republican party. If the DUP were to enter power sharing, it would be with that party, of which, but a short 3 months before, Dr. Paisley had said in a 12th of July celebration speech that Sinn Féin would only enter government in Northern Ireland over his dead body. Despite this pronouncement, in May 2007, a power-sharing executive was again established to govern Northern Ireland. The second Northern Ireland executive consisted of the DUP and Sinn Féin, with Ian Paisley of the DUP as First Minister and Sinn Féiner Martin McGuinness, prominent gunman and leader of the IRA, as Deputy First Minister. Although Dr. Paisley was the head of the government, he and Martin McGuinness held equal powers within the power-sharing arrangement. The terms First Minister and Deputy First Minister are misleading. It was acknowledged that the truth of the matter was that Ian Paisley could not issue a letter as First Minister without the approval of Martin McGuinness, the Deputy First Minister. They were politically equal and joined at the hip, as it were. There was a great measure of consternation amongst the supporters of Dr. Paisley when he spoke of the possibility of power sharing with unrepentant terrorists and murderers. There was a number of prominent DUP politicians who indicated to Dr. Paisley that they would not follow him into power sharing with Sinn Féin. It is widely reported that they were given the ultimatum of following him into power sharing with Sinn Féin or have London shut down the assembly, with the result of their large monthly salary and its accompanying expenses ceasing. The rebellion disappeared as quickly as snow off a ditch on a sunny spring day. However, there were those who broke with the DUP and began to campaign against the proposed power-sharing arrangement. A chief source of opposition was the Free Presbyterian Church, of which Dr. Paisley was the moderator at that time. It was declared within presbytery meetings from the spring of 2007 that for Dr. Paisley to occupy the chair at presbytery meetings and also hold the office of First Minister in a power-sharing executive with Sinn Féin was a conflict of interests which greatly compromised the gospel witness of the Free Presbyterian Church. A motion which I proposed was debated in the Presbytery of February 2007. The motion read, Dr. Paisley, should he enter upon the duties of the First Minister in a power-sharing executive with all its arduous duties, should simultaneously relinquish the office of moderator of the Free Presbyterian Church of Ulster in the interests of the well-being and unity of the Church. I said the following in support of the motion that I had proposed. It is not my purpose in proposing this motion to discuss at length the merits or demerits of the St. Andrew's Agreement. It is, however, my desire to have it recognized by all in this presbytery that there is a deep division of opinion within this presbytery and the Free Presbyterian Church generally about the St. Andrew's Agreement, and that we cannot remain indifferent to it. There are those who utterly reject the St. Andrew's Agreement and all that springs from it, because they deem it totally unacceptable to see the unrepentant murderers of many, many innocent people, Roman Catholic and Protestant, in government. This presbytery has accommodated diversity of political opinion in the past, and I hope that it will continue to do so. There is no divine authorization claimed for the St. Andrew's Agreement or the political coalition that it appears about to give birth to. There can therefore be no question of defying the will of God when one rejects the St. Andrew's Agreement. However, a real difficulty will arise for those who reject this agreement if Dr. Paisley takes up the office of First Minister in coalition with Martin McGuinness. This would mean that the Free Presbyterian Church would be linked undeniably through its moderator to a political regime and to the pronouncements and actions of that regime, which is utterly rejected by many in this presbytery and by many within the ranks of general church membership. In the past, our presbytery maintained that a link exists between church leaders and the members of the denominations they led. Even when the members rejected the actions of their leaders, it did not, in the view of Free Presbyterianism, exonerate them from being party to their leaders' activities. Such a view by our presbytery was, and is, perfectly scriptural. Only now it applies to us. I cannot repudiate the activities of the coalition government while the moderator of this presbytery leads that government. We as a church become linked to all that the coalition government will be and will do and will say. That would be totally unacceptable to many ministers and elders, as well as hundreds of members of our church. The Free Presbyterian Church must, at all costs, be yoked to none but Christ and His Word. We must not be linked in any way to that which will espouse views and policies that are repugnant to God and His precious Word. Who is there to say that Sinn Féin IRA can espouse anything other than that which is repugnant to God? This presbytery must maintain its independence and its freedom to speak for Christ without equivocation or inconsistency. I cannot imagine anyone disagreeing with this fundamental truth. To that end, I propose this motion. This debate was followed by other debates during the springtime of 2007, because there were those who were determined to support Dr. Paisley irrespective of the political about-turn that had taken place. A commission of presbytery was set up to consider over the summer whether or not there was a conflict of interests in Dr. Paisley holding these two offices. That commission reported at the September annual meeting of the presbytery, when customarily the offices of presbytery are declared open and nominations are received and voted upon for the filling of those offices for the incoming 12 months. The majority opinion of the commission was that it was incompatible for Dr. Paisley to hold the office of the First Minister of the power-sharing executive and also the moderatorship of the Free Presbyterian Church. Dr. Paisley had repeatedly said that he would not give up the office of First Minister, which he had held from May of that year. Therefore, it was proposed in that September presbytery meeting that he should not stand for the office of moderator. The outcome of the ensuing debate was that Dr. Paisley asked and was allowed to stand down at the end of 2007. It was widely believed that these well-publicized events within the Free Presbyterian Church gave rise to a current which saw Dr. Paisley removed by the Democratic Unionist Party from the office of First Minister and then a little later as leader of that party. This all took place within a period of just over 1 year. It was a traumatic and heartbreaking time for many within the Free Presbyterian Church, since it saw brethren of long standing pitted against brethren. It is difficult to write and speak of those times of anguish and grief which have occurred within living memory and in which you have played a part. It was indeed a time in which men had to decide the chief loyalty and love of their life. Was it a man greatly admired and greatly beloved for many, many years, or was it the Lord Jesus Christ and his precious word? I have no doubt that the simple gospel witness, begun in Ireland so long ago in the days of Patrick, and nourished and protected and preserved by heaven from the enemies of the gospel in the 17th, the 18th, the 19th, and 20th centuries, was once again preserved from extinction by this decision to withstand the effectual destruction of the separation and distinctions between the political kingdoms of men and Christ's kingdom, which God demands of his people. Unrepentant terrorists may come to power in Ulster thanks to the compromise and folly of ambitious politicians, some of whom profess faith in Christ, but God's cause is not defeated or destroyed. There is but a flickering flame today in comparison to the blessed conflagrations of former times, such as those of the 1630s, the 1700s, 1859, and the 1920s, and even those blessed days among the congregations of the Free Presbyterian Church within living memory in the 1960s and 1970s. In these latter times of blessing in Ulster, hundreds were saved and thousands separated from the ecumenical apostasy that blights the land today. Dozens of new Free Presbyterian congregations were formed throughout Ulster. But that God should, in the beginning of the 21st century, do this work and turn back the tide of compromise and betrayal yet again gives us hope that he has not forsaken his flock in Ulster, but will strengthen that which he has begun. We comfort ourselves in this hope with the words of Paul to the Philippian believers, being confident of this very thing, that he which hath begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. For it is God which worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Philippians chapter 1 and the verse 6 and chapter 2, the verse 13. May we, undeserving sinners that we are, see again a fulfillment of that sweet promise, so beloved of God's people in former times of trial. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Luke 12:32. I have long believed that the flame that God lit by the hand of Patrick long, long ago will still be burning in this island by God's grace when Jesus comes again. Amen. May it be so.
That was Reverend Ivan Foster, and that concludes A History of Ireland as it relates to the Ulster Scots. And again, our thanks to Reverend Foster, and we do hope all of you enjoyed and were benefited by this series of programs.